and the Cardinal fell choking and kicking to the floor. Out, along the corridor to the stairs, turn, knock, loose, and another man fell, and already a loud, jarring bell was filling the ship with its clangor. Up the stairs and out onto the deck, two sailors barred her way, and she said,
"Down there! The prisoner has got loose! Get help!"
That was enough to puzzle them, and they stood undecided, which gave her time to dodge past and seize her cloud vine from where she had hidden it behind the ventilator.
"Shoot her!"
came a cry in Mrs. Coulter's voice from behind, and at once three rifles fired, and the bullets struck metal and whined off into the fog as Seraphina leapt on the branch and urged it up like one of her own arrows. A few seconds later she was in the air, in the thick of the fog, safe, and then a great goose shape glided out of the wraiths of grey to her side.
"Where to?"
"Away, Kaiser, away! I want to get the stench of these people out of my nose."
In truth, she didn't know where to go or what to do next. But there was one thing she knew for certain. There was an arrow in her quiver that would find its mark in Mrs. Coulter's throat. They turned south, away from that troubling otherworld gleam in the fog, and as they flew a question began to form more clearly in Seraphina's mind. What was Lord Asriel doing? Because all the events that had overturned the world had their origin in his mysterious activities. The problem was that the usual sources of her knowledge were natural ones. She could track any animal, catch any fish, find the rarest berries, and she could read the signs in the pine marten's entrails, or decipher the wisdom in the scales of a perch, or interpret the warnings in the crocus pollen. But these were children of nature, and they told her natural truths. For knowledge about Lord Asriel, she had to go elsewhere. In the port of Trollesund, the witch's consul Dr. Lancelius maintained his contact with the world of men and women, and Seraphina Pecola sped there through the fog to see what he could tell her. Before she went to his house, she circled over the harbour, where wisps and tendrils of mist drifted ghost-like on the icy water, and watched as the pilot guided in a large vessel with an African registration. There were several other ships riding at anchor outside the harbour. She had never seen so many. As the short day faded, she flew down and landed in the back garden of the consul's house. She tapped on the window, and Dr. Lancelius himself opened the door, a finger to his lips.
"Seraphina Pecola, greetings. Come in quickly and welcome, but you had better not stay long."
He offered her a chair at the fireside, having glanced through the curtains out of a window that fronted the street.
"You'll have some wine?"
She sipped the golden tokay and told him of what she had seen and heard aboard the ship.
"Do you think they understood what she said about the child?"
"Not fully, I think. But they know she's important. As for that woman, I'm afraid of her, Dr. Lancelius. I shall kill her, I think, but still I'm afraid of her."
"Yes, so am I."
And Seraphina listened as he told her of the rumours that had swept the town. Amid the fog of rumour, a few facts had begun to emerge clearly.
"They say that the Magisterium is assembling the greatest army ever known, and this is an advance party. And there are unpleasant rumours about some of the soldiers, Seraphina Pecola. I've heard about Bolvanga and what they were doing there, cutting children's demons away. The most evil work I have ever heard of. Well, it seems there is a regiment of warriors who have been treated in the same way. Do you know the word zombie? They fear nothing because they are mindless. There are some in this town now. The authorities keep them hidden, but word gets out and the townspeople are terrified of them."
"What of the other witch clans? What news do you have of them?"
"Most have gone back to their homelands. All the witches are waiting, Seraphina Pecola, with fear in their hearts for what will happen next."
"And what do you hear of the church?"
"They're in complete confusion. You see, they don't know what Lord Asriel intends to do."
"Nor do I. And I can't imagine what it might be. What do you think he's intending, Dr. Lancelius?"
He gently rubbed the head of his serpent demon with his thumb.
"He is a scholar,"
he said after a moment.
"But scholarship is not his ruling passion, nor is statesmanship. I met him once, and I thought he had an ardent and powerful nature, but not a despotic one. I don't think he wants to rule." "I don't know, Seraphina Pecola. I suppose his servant might be able to tell you. He is a man called Thorold, and he was imprisoned with Lord Asriel in the house on Svalbard. Might be worth a visit there to see if he can tell you anything, but of course he might have gone into the other world with his master."
"Thank you. That's a good idea. I'll do it. And I'll go at once."
She said farewell to the consul and flew up through the gathering dark to join Kaiser in the clouds. Seraphina's journey to the north was made harder by the confusion in the world around her. All the Arctic peoples had been thrown into panic. And so are the animals, not only by the fog and the magnetic variations, but by unseasonal crackings of ice and stirrings in the soil. It was as if the earth itself, the permafrost, were slowly awakening from a long dream of being frozen. In all this turmoil, where sudden shafts of uncanny brilliance lanced down through rents in towers of fog and then vanished as quickly, where herds of musk-ox were seized by the urge to gallop south and then wheeled immediately to the west or the north again, where tight-knit skeins of geese disintegrated into a honking chaos as the magnetic fields they flew by wavered and snapped this way and that, Serafina Pekkala sat on her cloud-pine and flew north, to the house on the headland in the wastes of Svalbard. There she found Lord Asriel's servant, Thorold, fighting off a group of cliff ghasts. She saw the movement before she came close enough to see what was happening. There was a swirl of lunging leathery wings and a malevolent yowk, yowk, yowk resounding in the snowy courtyard. A single figure swathed in furs fired a rifle into the midst of them, with a gaunt dog-demon snarling and snapping beside him whenever one of the filthy things flew low enough. She didn't know the man, but a cliff ghast was an enemy always. She swung around above and loosed a dozen arrows into the melee. With shrieks and gibberings, the gang, too loosely organized to be called a troop, circled, saw their new opponent, and fled in confusion. A minute later the skies were bare again, and their dismayed yowk, yowk, yowk echoed distantly off the mountains before dwindling into silence. Serafina flew down to the courtyard and alighted on the trampled, blood-sprinkled snow. The man pushed back his hood, still holding his rifle warily because a witch was an enemy sometimes, and she saw an elderly man, long-jawed and grizzled and steady-eyed.
"I am a friend of Lyra's. I hope we can talk. Look, I lay my bow down."
"Where is the child?"
"In another world. I'm concerned for her safety, and I need to know what Lord Asriel is doing."
"Step inside, then. Luke, I lay my rifle down."
The formalities exchanged, they went indoors. Caïssa glided through the skies above, keeping watch, while Thorold brewed some coffee, and Serafina told him of her involvement with Lyra.
"She was always a willful child,"
he said when they were seated at the oaken table in the glow of a naphtha lamp.
"I'd see her every year or so when his lordship visited his college. I was fond of her, mind. You couldn't help it. But what her place was in the wider scheme of things, I don't know."
"What was Lord Asriel planning to do?"
"You don't think he told me, do you, Serafina Pekkala? I'm his manservant, that's all. I clean his clothes and cook his meals and keep his house tidy. I may have learned a thing or two in the years I've been with his lordship, but only by picking him up accidental. He wouldn't confide in me any more than in his shaving mug."
"Then tell me the thing or two you've learned by accident."
Thorold was an elderly man, but he was healthy and vigorous, and he felt flattered by the attention of this young witch and her beauty, as any man would. He was shrewd, though, too, and he knew the attention was not really on him, but on what he knew. And he was honest, so he did not draw out his telling for much longer than he needed.
"I can't tell you precisely what he's doing, because all the philosophical details are beyond my grasp. But I can tell you what drives his lordship, though he doesn't know I know. I've seen this in 100 little signs. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the witch people have different gods from ours. Ain't that right?"
"Yes, that's true."
"But you know about our god, the god of the church, the one they call the authority."
"Yes, I do."
"Well, Lord Asriel has never found himself at ease with the doctrines of the church, so to speak. I've seen a spasm of disgust cross his face when they talk of the sacraments and atonement and redemption and such like. It's death among our people, Serafina Pekkala, to challenge the church. But Lord Asriel's been nursing a rebellion in his heart for as long as I've served him. That's one thing I do know."
"A rebellion against the church?"
"Partly, aye. There was a time when he thought of making it an issue of force, but he turned away from that."
"Why? Was the church too strong?"
"No, that wouldn't stop my master. Now, this might sound strange to you, Serafina Pekkala, but I know the man better than any wife could know him. Better than a mother. He's been my master and my study for nigh on 40 years. I can't follow him to the height of his thought any more than I can fly. But I can see where he's a-heading, even if I can't go after him. No, it's my belief he turned away from a rebellion against the church, not because the church was too strong, but because it was too weak to be worth the fighting."
"So, what is he doing?"
"I think he's a waging a higher war than that. I think he's aiming a rebellion against the highest power of all. He's gone a-searching for the dwelling place of the Authority himself. And he's a-going to destroy him. That's what I think. It shakes my heart to voice it, ma'am. I hardly dare think of it, but I can't put together any other story that makes sense of what he's doing.
Seraphina sat quiet for a few moments, absorbing what Thorold had said. Before she could speak, he went on.
Of course, anyone setting out to do a grand thing like that would be the target of the Church's anger. Goes without saying. It'd be the most gigantic blasphemy. That's what they'd say. They'd have him before the consistorial court and sentenced to death before you could blink. I've never spoke of it before, and I shan't again. I'd be afraid to speak it aloud to you if you weren't a witch and beyond the power of the Church. But that makes sense, and nothing else does. He's a-going to find the Authority and kill him.
Is that possible?
Lord Asriel's life has been filled with things that were impossible. I wouldn't like to say there was anything he couldn't do. But on the face of it, Seraphina Pecola, yes, he's stark mad. If angels couldn't do it, how can a man dare to think about it?
Angels? What are angels?
Beings of pure spirit, the Church says. The Church teaches that some of the angels rebelled before the world was created and got flung out of heaven and into hell. They failed, you see, that's the point. They couldn't do it. And they had the power of angels. Lord Asriel is just a man with human power, no more than that. But his ambition is limitless. He dares to do what men and women don't even dare to think. And look what he's done already. He's torn open the sky. He's opened the way to another world. Who else has ever done that? Who else could think of it? So, with one part of me, Seraphina Pecola, I say he's mad, wicked, deranged. Yet, with another part, I think he's Lord Asriel. He's not like other men. Maybe, if it was ever going to be possible, it'd be done by him and by no one else.
And what will you do, Thorold?
I'll stay here and wait. I'll guard this house till he comes back and tells me different. Or till I die. And now I might ask you the same question, ma'am.
I'm going to make sure the child is safe. It might be that I have to pass this way again, Thorold. I'm glad to know that you will still be here.
I won't budge.
She refused Thorold's offer of food and said goodbye. A minute or so later she joined her goose demon again, and the demon kept silence with her as they soared and wheeled above the foggy mountains. She was deeply troubled, and there was no need to explain. Every strand of moss, every icy puddle, every midge in her homeland thrilled against her nerves and called her back. She felt fear for them, but fear of herself too, for she was having to change. These were human affairs she was inquiring into. This was a human matter. Lord Asriel's god was not hers. Was she becoming human? Was she losing her witchhood? If she were, she could not do it alone.
Home now. We must talk to our sisters, Kaisa. These events are too big for us alone.
And they sped through the roiling banks of fog towards Lake Enara and home. In the forested caves beside the lake, they found the others of their clan, and Lee Scoresby, too. The aeronaut had struggled to keep his balloon aloft after the crash at Svalbard, and the witches had guided him to their homeland, where he had begun to repair the damage to his basket and the gas bag.
Ma'am, I'm very glad to see you. Any news of the little girl?
None, Mr. Scoresby. Will you join our council tonight and help us discuss what to do?
The Texan blinked with surprise, for no man had ever been known to join a witch council.
I'd be greatly honored. I may have a suggestion or two of my own.
All through that day the witches came, like flakes of black snow on the wings of a storm, filling the skies with the darting flutter of their silk and the swish of air through the needles of their cloud pine branches. Men who hunted in the dripping forests or fished among melting ice floes heard the sky-wide whisper through the fog, and if the sky was clear they would look up to see the witches flying, like scraps of darkness drifting on a secret tide. By evening the pines around the lake were lit from below by 100 fires, and the greatest fire of all was built in front of the gathering cave. There, once they had eaten, the witches assembled. Seraphina Pecola sat in the center, the crown of little scarlet flowers nestling among her fair hair. On her left sat Lee Scoresby, and on her right, a visitor, the queen of the Latvian witches, whose name was Ruta Skadi. She had arrived only an hour before, to Serafina's surprise. Serafina had thought Mrs. Coulter beautiful for a short life, but Ruta Skadi was as lovely as Mrs. Coulter, with an extra dimension of the mysterious, the uncanny. She had trafficked with spirits, and it showed. She was vivid and passionate, with large black eyes. It was said that Lord Asriel himself had been her lover. She wore heavy gold earrings and a crown on her black curly hair, ringed with the fangs of snow tigers. Serafina's demon, Kaisa, had learned from Ruta Skadi's demon that she had killed the tigers herself in order to punish the Tatar tribe who worshipped them, because the tribesmen had failed to do her honor when she had visited their territory. Without their tiger gods, the tribe declined into fear and melancholy and begged her to allow them to worship her instead, only to be rejected with contempt. For what good would their worship do her, she asked. It had done nothing for the tigers. Such was Ruta Skadi, beautiful, proud, and pitiless. Serafina was not sure why she had come, but made the queen welcome, and etiquette demanded that Ruta Skadi should sit on Serafina's right. When they were all assembled, Serafina began to speak.
Sisters, you know why we have come together. We must decide what to do about these new events. The universe is broken wide, and Lord Asriel has opened the way from this world to another. Should we concern ourselves with it, or live our lives as we have done until now, looking after our own affairs? Then there is the matter of the child, Lyra Belacqua, now called Lyra Silvertongue by King Yorick Birnason. She chose the right cloud pine spray at the house of Dr. Lancelius. She is the child we have always expected, and now she has vanished. We have two guests who will tell us their thoughts. First, we shall hear Queen Ruta Skadi.
Ruta Skadi stood. Her white arms gleamed in the firelight. Her eyes glittered so brightly that even the farthest witch could see the play of expression on her vivid face.
Sisters, let me tell you what is happening and who it is that we must fight. For there is a war coming. I don't know who will join with us, but I know whom we must fight. It is the Magisterium, the Church. For all its history, and that's not long by our lives, but it's many, many of theirs, it's tried to suppress and control every natural impulse. And when it can't control them, it cuts them out. Some of you have seen what they did at Bolvanger, and that was horrible. But it is not the only such place, not the only such practice. Sisters, you know only the North. I have traveled in the Southlands. There are churches there, believe me, that cut their children too, as the people of Bolvanger did. Not in the same way, but just as horribly. They cut their sexual organs, yes, both boys and girls. They cut them with knives, so that they shan't feel. That is what the church does, and every church is the same. Control, destroy, obliterate every good feeling. So, if a war comes, and the church is on one side of it, we must be on the other, no matter what strange allies we find ourselves bound to. What I propose is that our clans join together and go north to explore this new world and see what we can discover there. If the child is not to be found in our world, it's because she will have gone after Lord Asriel already, and Lord Asriel is the key to this, believe me. He was my lover once, and I would willingly join forces with him, because he hates the church and all it does. That is what I have to say.
Ruta Skadi spoke passionately, and Serafina admired her power and her beauty. When the Latvian queen sat down, Serafina turned to Lee Scoresby.
Mr. Scoresby is a friend of the child's, and thus a friend of ours. Would you tell us your thoughts, sir?
The Texan got to his feet, whiplash lean and courteous. He looked as if he were not conscious of the strangeness of the occasion, but he was. His arctic-haired demon, Hester, crouched beside him, her ears flat along her back, her golden eyes half-closed.
Ma'am, I have to thank you all first for the kindness you've shown to me, and the help you extended to an aeronaut battered by winds that came from another world. I won't trespass long on your patience. When I was traveling north to Bovanger with the Egyptians, the child Lyra told me about something that happened in the college she used to live in, back in Oxford. Lord Asriel had shown the other scholars the severed head of a man called Stanislaus Groman, and that kind of persuaded them to give him some money to come north and find out what had happened. Now, the child was so sure of what she'd seen that I didn't like to question her too much, but what she said made a kind of memory come to my mind, except that I couldn't reach it clearly. I knew something about this Dr. Groman, and it was only on the flight here from Svalbard that I remembered what it was. It was an old hunter from Tungusk who told me. It seems that Groman knew the whereabouts of some kind of object that gives protection to whoever holds it. I don't want to belittle the magic that you witches can command, but this thing, whatever it is, as a kind of power that outclasses anything I've ever heard of, and I thought I might postpone my retirement to Texas because of my concern for that child and search for Dr. Groman. You see, I don't think he's dead. I think Lord Asriel was fooling those scholars. So I'm going to Nova Zembla, where I last heard of him alive, and I'm going to search for him. I can't see the future, but I can see the present clear enough, and I'm with you in this war, for what my bullets are worth. But that's the task I'm going to take on, ma'am.
He concluded, turning back to Serafina Pekala.
I'm going to seek out Stanislaus Groman and find out what he knows. And if I can find that object he knows of, I'll take it to Lyra.
Have you been married, Mr. Scoresby? Have you any children?
No, ma'am, I have no child, though I would have liked to be a father, but I understand your question, and you're right. That little girl has had bad luck with her true parents, and maybe I can make it up to her. Someone has to do it, and I'm willing.
Thank you, Mr. Scoresby.
And she took off her crown and plucked from it one of the little scarlet flowers that, while she wore them, remained as fresh as if they had just been picked.
Take this with you, and whenever you need my help, hold it in your hand and call to me. I shall hear you wherever you are.
Why, thank you, ma'am.
He took the little flower and tucked it carefully into his breast pocket.
And we shall call up a wind to help you to Nova Zembla. Now, sisters, who would like to speak?
The council proper began. The witches were democratic up to a point. Every witch, even the youngest, had the right to speak, but only their queen had the power to decide. The talk lasted all night, with many passionate voices for open war at once, and some others urging caution, and a few, though those were the wisest, suggesting a mission to all the other witch clans to urge them to join together for the first time. Rutaskadi agreed with that, and Serafina sent out messengers at once. As for what they should do immediately, Serafina picked out 20 of her finest fighters and ordered them to prepare to fly north with her into the new world that Lord Asriel had opened and search for Lyra.
What of you, Queen Rutaskadi? What are your plans?
I shall search for Lord Asriel and learn what he's doing from his own lips. And it seems that the way he's gone is northward, too. May I come the first part of the journey with you, sister?
You may, and welcome,
said Serafina, who was glad to have her company. So they agreed. But soon after the council had broken up, an elderly witch came to Serafina Pekala and said,
You had better listen to what Jutta Kamainen has to say, Queen. She's headstrong, but it might be important.
The young witch Jutta Kamainen, young by witch standards, that is, she was only just over 100 years old, was stubborn and embarrassed, and her robin demon was agitated, flying from her shoulder to her hand and circling high above her before settling again briefly on her shoulder. The witch's cheeks were plump and red. She had a vivid and passionate nature. Serafina didn't know her well.
Queen,
said the young witch, unable to stay silent under Serafina's gaze.
I know the man Stanislaus Groman. I used to love him, but I hate him now with such a fervor that if I see him, I shall kill him. I would have said nothing, but my sister made me tell you.
She glanced with hatred at the elder witch, who returned her look with compassion. She knew about love.
Well, if he is still alive, He'll have to stay alive until Mr. Scoresby finds him. You had better come with us into the new world, and then there'll be no danger of your killing him first. Forget him, Jutta Kamainen. Love makes us suffer, but this task of ours is greater than revenge. Remember that.
Yes, Queen.
And Serafina Pekela and her 21 companions, and Queen Rutaskari of Latvia, prepared to fly into the new world, where no witch had ever flown before. Chapter 3. A Children's World. Lyra was awake early. She'd had a horrible dream. She had been given the vacuum flask she'd seen her father, Lord Asriel, show to the master and scholars of Jordan College. When that had really happened, Lyra had been hiding in the wardrobe, and she'd watched as Lord Asriel opened the flask to show the scholars the severed head of Stanislaus Grumman, the lost explorer. But in her dream, Lyra had to open the flask herself, and she didn't want to. In fact, she was terrified. But she had to do it whether she wanted to or not, and she felt her hands weakening with dread as she unclipped the lid and heard the air rush into the frozen chamber. Then she lifted the lid away, nearly choking with fear, but knowing she had to do it. And there was nothing inside. The head had gone. There was nothing to be afraid of. But she awoke all the same, crying and sweating, in the hot little bedroom facing the harbour, with the moonlight streaming through the window, and lay in someone else's bed, clutching someone else's pillow, with the ermine pantalaimon nuzzling her and making soothing noises. Oh, she was so frightened. And how odd it was that in real life she had been eager to see the head of Stanislaus Grumman, and had begged Lord Asriel to open the flask again and let her look. And yet in her dream she was so terrified. When morning came, she asked the alethiometer what the dream meant, but all it said was, it was a dream about a head. She thought of waking the strange boy, but he was so deeply asleep that she decided not to. Instead, she went down to the kitchen and tried to make an omelette, and 20 minutes later she sat down at a table on the pavement and ate the blackened, gritty thing with great pride, while the sparrow pantalaimon pecked at the bits of shell. She heard a sound behind her, and there was Will, heavy-eyed with sleep.
I can make omelette. I'll make you some if you like.
He looked at her plate and said,
No, I'll have some cereal. There's still some milk in the fridge that's all right. They can't have been gone very long, the people who lived here.
She watched him shake cornflakes into a bowl and pour milk on them, something else she'd never seen before. He carried the bowl outside and said,
If you don't come from this world, where's your world? How did you get here?
Over a bridge. My father made this bridge, and I followed him across. But he's gone somewhere else, I don't know where. I don't care. But while I was walking across, there was so much fog, and I got lost, I think. I walked around in the fog for days, just eating berries and stuff I found. Then one day the fog cleared, and we was up on that cliff back there.
She gestured behind her. Will looked along the shore, past the lighthouse, and saw the coast rising in a great series of cliffs that disappeared into the haze of the distance.
And we saw the town here and came down, but there was no one here. At least there were things to eat and beds to sleep in. We didn't know what to do next.
You sure this isn't another part of your world?
Course. This ain't my world. I know that for certain.
Will remembered his own absolute certainty on seeing the patch of grass through the window in the air that it wasn't in his world, and he nodded.
So there's three worlds at least that are joined on.
There's millions and millions. This other demon told me. He was a witch's demon. No one can count how many worlds there are, all in the same space. But no one could get from one to another before my father made this bridge.
What about the window I found?
I don't know about that. Maybe all the worlds are starting to move into one another.
And why are you looking for dust?
She looked at him coldly.
I might tell you sometime.
All right. But how are you going to look for it?
I'm going to find a scholar who knows about it.
What, any scholar?
No, an experimental theologian. In my Oxford, they were the ones who knew about it. Stands to reason it'll be the same in your Oxford. I'll go to Jordan College first, because Jordan had the best ones.
I never heard of experimental theology.
They know all about elementary particles and fundamental forces, and ambaromagnetism, stuff like that. Atomcraft.
What magnetism?
Ambaromagnetism. Like ambaric, those lights?
She said, pointing up at the ornamental streetlight.
They're Ambaric.
We call them electric.
Electric? That's like electrum. That's a kind of stone, a jewel, made out of gum from trees. There's insects in it, sometimes.
You mean amber?
He said, and they both said...
Amber!
And each of them saw their own expression on the other's face. Will remembered that moment for a long time afterward.
Well, electromagnetism...
He went on, looking away.
Sounds like what we call physics, your experimental theology. You want scientists, not theologians.
Ah, I'll find them.
They sat in the wide, clear morning, with the sun glittering placidly on the harbour, and each of them might have spoken next, because both of them were burning with questions. But then they heard a voice from farther along the harbour front, toward the casino gardens. Both of them looked there, startled. It was a child's voice, but there was no one in sight.
How long did you say you'd been here?
3 days, four. I lost count. I never seen anyone. There's no one here. I looked almost everywhere.
But there was. Two children, one a girl of Lyra's age and the other a younger boy, came out of one of the streets leading down to the harbour. They were carrying baskets and both had red hair. They were about 100 yards away when they saw Will and Lyra at the cafe table. Pantalaimon changed from a goldfinch to a mouse and ran up Lyra's arm to the pocket of her shirt. He'd seen that these new children were like Will. Neither of them had a demon visible. The two children wandered up and sat at a table nearby.
You from Gigazzi?
Will shook his head.
From Sant'Elia?
No, we're from somewhere else.
The girl nodded. This was a reasonable reply.
What's happening? Where are the grown-ups?
The girl's eyes narrowed.
Didn't the specters come to your city?
No. We just got here. We don't know about spectres. What is this city called?
Cigazzi. Cittagazzi, all right?
Cittagazzi. Cigazzi. Why do the grown-ups have to leave?
Because of the spectres. What's your name?
Lyra. And he's Will. What's yours?
Angelica. My brother is Paolo.
Where have you come from?
Up the hills. There was a big fog and storm and everyone was frightened, so we all ran up in the hills. Then when the fog cleared, the grown-ups could see with telescopes that the city was full of specters, so they couldn't come back. But the kids, we ain't afraid of specters, all right? There's more kids coming down. They'll be here later, but we're first.
Who's in Tullio?
Said little Paolo proudly.
Who's Tullio?
Angelica was cross. Paolo shouldn't have mentioned him, but the secret was out now.
Our big brother. He ain't with us. He's hiding till he can... He's just hiding.
He's gonna get...
Paolo began, but Angelica smacked him hard, and he shut his mouth at once, pressing his quivering lips together.
What did you say about the city? It's full of spectres.
Yeah, Cigazzi, Sant'Elia, all cities. The spectres go where the people are. Where are you from?
Winchester.
I never heard of it. They ain't got spectres there?
No, I can't see any here either.
Course not. You ain't grown up. When we grow up, we see spectres.
I ain't afraid of spectres, all right?
The little boy said, thrusting forward his grubby chin.
Kill the buggers!
Ain't the grown-ups gonna come back at all?
Yeah, in a few days, when the spectres go somewhere else. We like it when the spectres come, cos we can run about in the city, do what we like, all right?
But what do the grown-ups think the spectres will do to them?
Well, when a spectre catch a grown-up, oh, that's bad to see. They eat the life out of them there and then, all right? I don't want to be grown up for sure. At first, they know it's happening, and they're afraid. They cry and cry. They try and look away and pretend it ain't happening, but it is. It's too late, and no one ain't gonna go near them. They on their own. Then they get pale, and they stop moving. They're still alive, but it's like they've been eaten from inside. You look in the eyes, you see the back of their heads. Ain't nothing there.
The girl turned to her brother and wiped his nose on the sleeve of his shirt.
Me and Paolo's going to look for ice creams. You want to come and find some?
No. We got something else to do.
Goodbye, then,
she said. And Paolo said,
Kill specters!
Goodbye.
As soon as Angelica and the little boy had vanished, Pantalaimon appeared from Lyra's pocket, his mouse head ruffled and bright-eyed.
They don't know about this window you found.
It was the first time Will had heard him speak, and he was almost more startled by that than by anything else he'd seen so far. Lyra laughed at his astonishment.
But he spoke. Do all demons talk?
Of course they do. Did you think he was just a pet?
Will rubbed his hair and blinked. Then he shook his head.
No,
he said, addressing Pantalaimon.
You're right, I think. They don't know about it.
So, we'd better be careful how we go through.
It was strange for only a moment, talking to a mouse. Then it was no more strange than talking into a telephone, because he was really talking to Lyra. But the mouse was separate. There was something of Lyra in his expression, but something else too. It was too hard to work out when there were so many strange things happening at once. Will tried to bring his thoughts together.
You got to find some other clothes first, before you go into my Oxford.
Why?
Because you can't go and talk to people in my world looking like that. They wouldn't let you near them. You got to look as if you fit in. You've got to go about camouflaged. I know, see. I've been doing it for years. You better listen to me, or you'll get caught. And if they find out where you come from, and the window, and everything... Well, this is a good hiding place, this world. See, I got to hide from some men. This is the best hiding place I could dream of, and I don't want it found out. So I don't want you giving it away by looking out of place, or as if you don't belong. I've got my own things to do in Oxford, and if you give me away, I'll kill you.
She swallowed. The alethiometer never lied. This boy was a murderer, and if he'd killed before, he could kill her too. She nodded seriously, and she meant it.
All right.
Pantalaimon had become a lemur, and was gazing at him with disconcerting wide eyes. Will stared back, and the demon became a mouse once more and crept into Lyra's pocket.
Good. Now, while we're here, we'll pretend to these other kids that we just come from somewhere in their world. It's good there aren't any grown-ups about. We can just come and go and no one will notice. But in my world, you've got to do as I say. And the first thing is, you better wash yourself. You need to look clean or you'll stand out. We got to be camouflaged everywhere we go. We got to look as if we belong there so naturally that people don't even notice us. So go and wash your hair for a start. There's some shampoo in the bathroom. Then we'll go and find some different clothes.
I don't know how. I never wash my hair. The housekeeper had done it at Jordan, and then I never needed to after that.
Well, you'll just have to work it out. Wash yourself all over. In my world, people are clean.
Said Lyra, and went upstairs. A ferocious rat face glared at him over her shoulder, but he looked back coldly. Part of him wanted to wander about this sunny, silent morning, exploring the city, and another part trembled with anxiety for his mother, and another part was still numb with shock at the death he'd caused, and overhanging them all was the task he had to do. But it was good to keep busy, so while he waited for Lyra, he cleaned the working surfaces in the kitchen, and washed the floor, and emptied the rubbish into the bin he found in the alley outside. Then he took the green leather writing case from his tote bag and looked at it longingly. As soon as he'd shown Lyra how to get through the window into his Oxford, he'd come back and look at what was inside. But in the meanwhile, he tucked it under the mattress of the bed he'd slept in. In this world, it was safe. When Lyra came down, clean and wet, they left to look for some clothes for her. They found a department store, shabby like everywhere else, with clothes in styles that looked a little old-fashioned to Will's eye, but they found Lyra a tartan skirt and a green sleeveless blouse with a pocket for Pantalaimon. She refused to wear jeans, refused even to believe Will when he told her that most girls did.
They're trousers! I'm a girl, don't be stupid!
He shrugged. The tartan skirt looked unremarkable, which was the main thing. Before they left, Will dropped some coins in the till behind the counter.
What are you doing?
Paying. You have to pay for things. Don't they pay for things in your world?
They don't in this one. I bet those other kids aren't paying for a thing.
They might not, but I do.
If you start behaving like a grown-up, the spectres will get you,
she said, but she didn't know whether she could tease him yet or whether she should be afraid of him. In the daylight, Will could see how ancient the buildings in the heart of the city were, and how near to ruin some of them had come. Holes in the road had not been repaired, windows were broken, plaster was peeling... And yet there had once been a beauty and grandeur about this place. Through carved archways they could see spacious courtyards filled with greenery, and there were great buildings that looked like palaces, for all that the steps were cracked and the door frames loose from the walls. It looked as if, rather than knock a building down and build a new one, the citizens of Chigatse preferred to patch it up indefinitely. At one point they came to a tower standing on its own in a little square. It was the oldest building they'd seen, a simple, battlemented tower 4 stories high. Something about its stillness in the bright sun was intriguing, and both Will and Lyra felt drawn to the half-open door at the top of the broad steps. But they didn't speak of it, and they went on a bit reluctantly. When they reached the broad boulevard with the palm trees, he told her to look for a little cafe on a corner with green-painted metal tables on the pavement outside. They found it within a minute. It looked smaller and shabbier by daylight, but it was the same place, with the zinc-topped bar, the espresso machine, and the half-finished plate of risotto, now beginning to smell bad in the warm air.
Is it in here?
No, it's in the middle of the road. Make sure there's no other kids around.
But they were alone. Will took her to the grassy median under the palm trees and looked around to get his bearings.
I think it was about here. When I came through, I could just about see that big hill behind the white house up there. And looking this way, there was the cafe there, and...
What's it look like? I can't see anything.
Oh, you won't mistake it. It doesn't look like anything you've ever seen.
He cast up and down. Had it vanished? Had it closed? He couldn't see it anywhere. And then suddenly he had it. He moved back and forth, watching the edge. Just as he'd found the night before, on the Oxford side of it, you could only see it at all from one side. When you moved behind it, it was invisible. And the sun on the grass beyond it was just like the sun on the grass on this side, except unaccountably different.
Here it is.
I see it!
She was agog. She looked as astounded as he looked himself to hear Pantalaimon talk. Her demon, unable to remain inside her pocket, had come out to be a wasp, and he buzzed up to the hole and back several times while she rubbed her still slightly wet hair into spikes.
Keep to one side. If you stand in front of it, people would just see a pair of legs, and that would make him curious. I don't want anyone noticing.
What's that noise?
Traffic. It's a part of the Oxford Ring Road. It's bound to be busy. Get down and look at it from the side. It's the wrong time of day to go through, really. There's far too many people about. But it would be hard to find somewhere to go if we went in the middle of the night. At least once we're through, we can blend in easy. You go first. Just duck through quickly and move out of the way.
She had a little blue rucksack that she'd been carrying since they left the cafe, and she unslung it and held it in her arms before crouching to look through.
Oh, and that's your world? That don't look like any part of Oxford. You sure you was in Oxford?
Of course I'm sure. When you go through, you'll see a road right in front of you. Go to the left, and then a little farther along, you take the road that goes down to the right. That leads to the city centre. Make sure you can see where this window is, and remember, all right, it's the only way back.
Right. I won't forget.
Taking her rucksack in her arms, she ducked through the window in the air and vanished. Will crouched down to see where she went. And there she was, standing on the grass in his Oxford with Pan still as a wasp on her shoulder, and no one, as far as he could tell, had seen her appear. Cars and trucks raced past a few feet beyond, and no driver at this busy junction would have had time to gaze sideways at an odd-looking bit of air, even if they could see it, and the traffic screened the window from anyone looking across from the far side. There was a squeal of brakes, a shout, a bang. He flung himself down to look. Lyra was lying on the grass. A car had braked so hard that a van had struck it from behind and knocked the car forward anyway, and there was Lyra lying still. Will darted through after her. No one saw him come. All eyes were on the car, the crumpled bumper, the van driver getting out, and on the little girl.
I couldn't help it. She ran out in front. You were too close.
Never mind that. How's the kid?
The van driver was addressing Will, who was on his knees beside Lyra. Will looked up and around, but there was nothing for it. He was responsible. On the grass next to him, Lyra was moving her head about, blinking hard. Will saw the wasp Pantalaimon crawling dazedly up a grass stem beside her.
You are right. Move your legs and arms.
Stupid! Just ran out in front! Didn't look once! What am I supposed to do?
Are you still there, love?
Yeah.
Everything working?
Move your feet and hands.
She did. There was nothing broken.
She's all right. I'll look after her. She's fine.
Do you know her?
She's my sister. It's all right. We just live around the corner. I'll take her home.
Lyra was sitting up now, and as she was obviously not badly hurt, the woman turned her attention back to the car. The rest of the traffic was moving around the two stationary vehicles, and as they went past, the drivers looked curiously at the little scene, as people always do. Will helped Lyra up. The sooner they moved away, the better. The woman and the van driver had realized that their argument ought to be handled by their insurance companies, and were exchanging addresses when the woman saw Will helping Lyra to limp away.
Wait! You'll be witnesses. I need your name and address.
I'm Mark Ransom, and my sister's Lisa. We live at 26 Bourne Close.
Postcode?
Ugh, I can never remember. Look, I want to get her home.
Hop in the cab and I'll take you round.
No, it's no trouble. It'll be quicker to walk on it.
Lyra wasn't limping badly. She walked away with Will, back along the grass under the hornbeam trees, and turned at the first corner they came to. They sat on a low garden wall.
You hurt?
Banged me leg. And when I fell down, it shook me head.
But she was more concerned about what was in the rucksack. She felt inside it, brought out a heavy little bundle wrapped in black velvet, and unfolded it. Will's eyes widened to see the alethiometer, the tiny symbols painted around the face, the golden hands, the questing needle, the heavy richness of the case took his breath away.
What's that?
It's my alethiometer. It's a truth-teller, a symbol reader. I hope it ain't broken.
But it was unharmed. Even in her trembling hands, the long needle swung steadily. She put it away and said,
I never seen so many carts and things. I never guessed they was going so fast.
They don't have cars and vans in your Oxford.
Not so many. Not like these ones. I wasn't used to it. But I'm all right now.
Well, be careful from now on. If you go and walk under a bus or get lost or something, they'll realise you're not from this world and start looking for the way through.
He was far more angry than he needed to be. Finally, he said,
All right, look. If you pretend you're my sister, that'll be a disguise for me, because the person they're looking for hasn't got a sister. And if I'm with you, I can show you how to cross roads without getting killed.
All right.
And money. I bet you haven't... Well, how could you have any money? How are you going to get around and eat and so on?
I have got money,
she said, and shook some gold coins out of her purse. Will looked at them incredulously.
Is that gold? It is, isn't it? Well, that will get people asking questions and no mistake. You're just not safe. I'll give you some money. Put those coins away and keep them out of sight. And remember, you're my sister and your name's Lisa Ransom.
Lizzie. I pretended to call myself Lizzie before. I can remember that.
All right, Lizzie, then. And I'm Mark, don't forget.
All right.
Her leg was going to be painful. Already it was red and swollen where the car had struck it, and a dark, massive bruise was forming. What with the bruise on her cheek where he'd struck her the night before, she looked as if she'd been badly treated, and that worried him too. Suppose some police officer should become curious. He tried to put it out of his mind, and they set off together, crossing at the traffic lights and casting just one glance back at the window under the hornbeam trees. They couldn't see it at all. It was quite invisible, and the traffic was flowing again. In Summertown, 10 minutes' walk down the Banbury Road, Will stopped in front of a bank.
What are you doing?
I'm going to get some money. Probably better not do it too often, but they won't register it till the end of the working day, I shouldn't think.
He put his mother's bank card into the automatic teller and tapped out her PIN number. Nothing seemed to be going wrong, so he withdrew £100, and the machine gave it up without a hitch. Lyra watched, open-mouthed. He gave her a £20 note.
Use that later. Buy something and get some change. Let's find a bus into town.
Lyra let him deal with the bus. She sat very quietly, watching the houses and gardens of the city that was hers and not hers. It was like being in someone else's dream. They got off in the city centre next to an old stone church, which she did know, opposite a big department store, which she didn't.
It's all changed. Like... That ain't the Corn Market, and this is the Broad. There's Balliol and Bodley's Library down there. But where's Jordan?
Now she was trembling badly. It might have been delayed reaction from the accident, or present shock from finding an entirely different building in place of the Jordan College she knew as home.
That ain't right.
She spoke quietly because Will had told her to stop pointing out so loudly the things that were wrong.
This is a different Oxford.
Well, we knew that.
He wasn't prepared for Lyra's wide-eyed helplessness. He couldn't know how much of her childhood had been spent running about streets almost identical with these, and how proud she'd been of belonging to Jordan College, whose scholars were the cleverest, whose coffers the richest, whose beauty the most splendid of all. And now it simply wasn't there, and she wasn't Lyra of Jordan any more. She was a lost little girl in a strange world, belonging nowhere.
Well, if it ain't here...
It was going to take longer than she thought, that was all. Chapter 4. Trepanning. As soon as Lyra had gone her way, Will found a payphone and dialed the number of the lawyer's office on the letter he held.
Hello. I want to speak to Mr. Perkins.
Who's calling, please?
It's in connection with Mr. John Parry. I'm his son.
Just a moment, please.
A minute went by, and then a man's voice said,
Hello, this is Alan Perkins. To whom am I speaking?
William Parry. Excuse me for calling. It's about my father, Mr. John Parry. You send money every 3 months from my father to my mother's bank account.
Yes.
Well, I want to know where my father is, please. Is he alive or dead?
How old are you, William?
12. I want to know about him.
Yes. Has your mother... Is she... Does she know you're phoning me?
Will thought carefully.
No. But she's not in very good health. She can't tell me very much, and I want to know.
Yes, I see. Where are you now? Are you at home?
No, I'm in Oxford.
On your own?
Yes.
And your mother's not well, you say?
No.
Is she in hospital or something?
Something like that. Look, can you tell me or not?
Well, I can tell you something, but not much and not right now, and I'd rather not do it over the phone. I'm seeing a client in 5 minutes. Can you find your way to my office at about 2:30?
No,
Will said. It would be too risky. The lawyer might have heard by then that he was wanted by the police. He thought quickly and went on.
I've got to catch a bus to Nottingham, and I don't want to miss it. But what I want to know, you can tell me over the phone, can't you? All I want to know is my father alive? And if he is, where can I find him? You can tell me that, can't you?
It's not quite as simple as that. I can't really give out private information about a client unless I'm sure the client would want me to. And I'd need some proof of who you were, anyway.
Yes, I understand. But can you just tell me whether he's alive or dead?
Well, that wouldn't be confidential. Unfortunately, I can't tell you anyway, because I don't know.
What?
The money comes from a family trust. He left instructions to pay it until he told me to stop. I haven't heard from him from that day to this. What it boils down to is that he's... Well, I suppose he's vanished. That's why I can't answer your question.
Vanished? Just lost?
It's a matter of public record, actually. Look, why don't you come into the office and...
I can't. I'm going to Nottingham.
Well, write to me, or get your mother to write, and I'll let you know what I can. But you must understand, I can't do very much over the phone.
Yes, I suppose so. All right. But can you tell me where he disappeared?
As I say, it's a matter of public record. There were several newspaper stories at the time. You know he was an explorer.
My mother's told me some things, yes.
Well, he was leading an expedition, and it just disappeared. About 10 years ago, maybe more.
Where?
The far north. Alaska, I think. You can look it up in the public library. Why don't you...
But at that point, Will's money ran out, and he didn't have any more change. The dial tone purred in his ear. He put the phone down and looked around. What he wanted above all was to speak to his mother. He had to stop himself from dialing Mrs. Cooper's number, because if he heard his mother's voice, it would be very hard not to go back to her, and that would put both of them in danger. But he could send her a postcard. He chose a view of the city and wrote,
Dear Mum, I am safe and well, and I will see you again soon. I hope everything is all right. I love you. Will.
Then he addressed it and bought a stamp and held the card close to him for a minute before dropping it in the mailbox. It was mid-morning and he was in the main shopping street where buses shouldered their way through crowds of pedestrians. He began to realize how exposed he was, for it was a weekday when a child of his age should have been in school. Where could he go? It didn't take him long to hide. Will could vanish easily enough because he was good at it. He was even proud of his skill. Like Serafina Pekala on the ship, he simply made himself part of the background. So now, knowing the sort of world he lived in, he went into a stationery shop and bought a ballpoint, a pad of paper, and a clipboard. Schools often send groups of pupils off to do a shopping survey or something of the sort, and if he seemed to be on a project like that, he wouldn't look as if he was at a loose end. Then he wandered along, pretending to be making notes, and kept his eyes open for the public library. Meanwhile, Lyra was looking for somewhere quiet to consult the alethiometer. In her own Oxford there would have been a dozen places within 5 minutes' walk, but this Oxford was so disconcertingly different, with patches of poignant familiarity right next to the downright outlandish. Why had they painted those yellow lines on the road? What were those little white patches dotting every sidewalk? In her own world, they had never heard of chewing gum. What could those red and green lights mean at the corner of the road? It was all much harder to read than the alethiometer. But here were St. John's College gates, which she and Roger had once climbed after dark to plant fireworks in the flower beds. And that particular worn stone at the corner of Cat Street, there were the initials SP that Simon Parslow had scratched, the very same ones. She'd seen him do it. Someone in this world with the same initials must have stood here idly and done exactly the same. There might be a Simon Parslow in this world. Perhaps there was a Lyra. A chill ran down her back and mouse-shaped pantalaimon shivered in her pocket. She shook herself. There were mysteries enough without imagining more. The other way in which this Oxford differed from hers was in the vast numbers of people swarming on every sidewalk in and out of every building. People of every sort, women dressed like men, Africans, even a group of Tartars meekly following their leader, all neatly dressed and hung about with little black cases. She glared at them fearfully at first because they had no demons, and in her world they would have been regarded as ghasts or worse. But this was the strangest thing. They all looked fully alive. These creatures moved about cheerfully enough for all the world as though they were human, and Lyra had to concede that human was what they probably were, and that their demons were inside them, as Will's was. After wandering about for an hour, taking the measure of this mock Oxford, she felt hungry and bought a bar of chocolatl with her £20 note. The shopkeeper looked at her oddly, but he was from the Indies and didn't understand her accent, perhaps, although she asked very clearly. With a change she bought an apple from the covered market, which was much more like the proper Oxford, and walked up towards the park. There she found herself outside a grand building, a real Oxford-looking building that didn't exist in her world at all, though it wouldn't have looked out of place. She sat on the grass outside to eat, and regarded the building approvingly. She discovered that it was a museum. The doors were open, and inside she found stuffed animals and fossil skeletons and cases of minerals, just like the Royal Geological Museum she'd visited with Mrs. Coulter in her London. At the back of the great iron and glass hall was the entrance to another part of the museum, and because it was nearly deserted, she went through and looked around. The alethiometer was still the most urgent thing on her mind, but in this second chamber she found herself surrounded by things she knew well. There were showcases filled with Arctic clothing, just like her own furs, with sledges and walrus ivory carvings and seal-hunting harpoons, with 1,001 jumbled trophies and relics and objects of magic and tools and weapons, and not only from the Arctic, as she saw, but from every part of this world. Well, how strange. Those caribou skin furs were exactly the same as hers, but they tied the traces on that sledge completely wrong. But here was a photogram showing some Samoyed hunters, the very doubles of the ones who caught Lyra and sold her to Bolvanger. Look, they were the same men. And even that rope had frayed and been re-knotted in precisely the same spot, and she knew it intimately, having been tied up in that very sledge for several agonizing hours. What were these mysteries? Was there only one world, after all, which spent its time dreaming of others? And then she came across something that made her think of the alethiometer again. In an old glass case with a black-painted wooden frame, there were a number of human skulls, and some of them had holes in them, some at the front, some on the side, some on the top. The one in the center had two. This process, it said in spidery writing on a card, was called trepanning. The card also said that all the holes had been made during the owner's lifetimes because the bone had healed and grown smooth around the edge. One, however, hadn't. The hole had been made by a bronze arrowhead which was still in it, and its edges were sharp and broken, so you could tell it was different. This was just what the northern Tartars did. And what Stanislaus Grumman had had done to himself, according to the Jordan scholars who'd known him. Lyra looked around quickly, saw no one nearby, and took out the alethiometer. She focused her mind on the central skull and asked, what sort of person did this skull belong to, and why did they have those holes made in it? As she stood concentrating in the dusty light that filtered through the glass roof and slanted down past the upper galleries, she didn't notice that she was being watched. A powerful-looking man in his 60s, wearing a beautifully tailored linen suit and holding a Panama hat, stood on the gallery above and looked down over the iron railing. His grey hair was brushed neatly back from his smooth, tanned, barely wrinkled forehead. His eyes were large, dark and long-lashed and intense,